Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with Jenda Juan. Jenda is the field organizer for the American Humanist Association. Welcome, Jenda.
Nice to be here.
I want to start by going back to the beginning, because humanism has so many different meanings, and I know that there's a 400, 500-year history of this term. So we want to talk about what does the American Humanist Association mean by it, and where did the AHA come from?
Okay. The way the AHA defines humanism, we had a document that we recently put out, Humanist Manifesto 3, Humanism and Its Aspirations, and the short definition we use is, humanism is a progressive philosophy of life that, without supernaturalism, affirms our ability and responsibility to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment that aspire to the greater good of humanity. So that's kind of the really short definition in a nutshell that we use. And AHA itself was founded in 1941, although it has origins going back to about the 1920s. And basically, it came out of Unitarianism back then. The original manifesto, the first Humanist Manifesto that was written in 1933, was drafted by Unitarians and signed by, I believe, 19 ministers out of the 33 people who signed the first manifesto. So we kind of trace our origins back then, and then in 1941, our organization was officially formed, and we started publishing the Humanist magazine, which is still something that we have out. It's a bi-monthly publication that we have. So
now, it's interesting that you say that the definition for you guys of humanism is that you can affirm the possibility of having an ethical life and finding meaning without supernaturalism, but it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing as being an atheist. So there is a possibility, and the original humanists, in terms of historical use of the term, were in fact Catholics who thought that human beings were such a great creation of God that we should celebrate humanity, right?
Right, yeah. A lot of humanists don't specifically identify as atheists, because they do prefer the term humanism to it. But for the most part, though, the way the AHA sees it is that you pretty much do have to, lack a belief in a God or supreme being in order to really be a fully consistent humanist, because, you know, we do accept naturalism as, you know, as the best way to kind of understand the world that we live in, and we don't see any kind of proof for supernaturalism. So that would include any kind of God belief or anything like that. So.
Now, when did you get involved personally in the humanist movement?
I've pretty much been involved since high school, which is when I realized that I was an atheist. And when I went into college, I joined a campus group, University of Minnesota Atheists and Humanists. And that's actually when I specifically started learning more about humanism, and I went to some national conferences in Chicago and whatnot, and got more and more involved. And then I got involved with groups like the Secular Student Alliance, which I was a board member of. And then I ended up interning at the American Humanist Association 2 summers ago, kind of doing field work, working with our chapters and affiliates and whatnot. And then I've been with them ever since.
Now, the Secular Student Alliance has been one of your principal organizational responsibilities, getting that going and coordinating its activities. I understand it's enjoyed explosive growth in recent years.
Yeah. We just started in the year 2000, and right now we're in contact with 45 student groups on campuses around the country, and we're in touch with at least 20 or so students who are interested in trying to start groups. So we have, it's been about a year now, we've had a campus organizer, a full-time guy, and he's going to be heading off to law school now, so we've just hired a replacement for Rob. So we're doing good with that, and he's been doing a lot of field work and kind of talking with kids, you know, on the phone, over email, using instant messenger to kind of get them the materials and tools that they need in order to have, in order to start and basically sustain like a successful student group. And we just came out with a grassroots manual, or a group running guide is actually the term, for students that they've been distributing across campuses for kids who either have a group and want to kind of, you know, have a booklet that has all the techniques for what to do and how to do this and that, as well as for students who are interested in starting a group and don't necessarily know what to do.
I'm very sympathetic with that effort because I, when I was a young socialist student organizer, I put together a similar manual. It's the architecture and the science of organizing student activities is has a long history, and there's quite an art to it. One of the big problems is there's so much turnover on campuses that you build something and immediately it evaporates.
Yeah, that's definitely a big problem, and that's something we've noticed for a long time. So the SSA has been trying to put in kind of institutional checks to help make sure that there is more continual leadership and whatnot. We do that by promoting the idea of having an advisor for your group, which would normally be someone who's not a student, someone maybe who's a professor, or maybe someone who's a member of your local atheist or humanist group, off campus in your city. That can kind of be there, and that can be like the transitional person and the contact person throughout the years. And the SSA has also implemented something called OR, which is Openness, Accountability, and Responsiveness. And it's just a new program we put in order to ensure that we keep accurate, up-to-date lists about groups and we know who's in charge and whatnot, that every semester, the student group, in order to continue to be listed as an SSA group and whatnot, just has to fill out a quick 10-minute form letting us know the status of the group, like where it's at, how many members, what kind of events are you doing, have your contact information changed or anything like that. So we're doing those just kind of so that we can keep, in the know, and then if a student group is starting to slip for whatever reason, then the campus organizer can kind of give it some particular attention, send it some more materials, work with the advisor, or do whatever is necessary to make sure that the group keeps going.
I can really sympathize with that. I'm trying to keep track of all the meetings and activities of a global organization, the World Transhumanist Association, and it gets pretty tenuous sometimes when you can't really get to an idea of what's happening there in Lagos,
Yeah, it's a lot of it's just paperwork, it seems like.
So here's something that's always been curious to me about the organizing of progressive organizations in the U.S. Do you see more growth and growth potential in areas where there already are a lot of progressive groups, or is it better in the dissident faction of three students at Oral Roberts University? Are they the ones who are really going to be the hot ticket to organize?
On a lot of more liberal campuses, and like on a lot of public universities, like the campus I went to, we had a pretty strong group, and we weren't extreme. Our campus wasn't extremely liberal, but yeah, when you look at a lot more colleges and universities, say up in the Northeast and stuff like that, it does become a little bit harder to organize because the ideas of atheism, humanism, secularism, free thinking are kind of already default assumptions for a lot of students, so they don't see the need to actually organize specifically around these issues. And a lot of students may feel that, they're expressing their humanism through joining, other groups like Amnesty International or kind of working for campaign reform and things like that. So they don't see that need for a specific group to focus on humanism and atheism because, already all their friends, everyone that they're talking to, already from that point of view, and they don't feel that there's that much of a threat. So yeah, and the SSA, there actually have been a few successful, some more short-lived than others, groups on Catholic universities. There was a group, St. Thomas University, which is a Catholic school in Minneapolis, that unfortunately has died away, but it was there for 2 years. And St. Catherine's, which is a school in St. Paul in Minnesota as well, also right now has an active, I believe it's still an active group. So, I mean, I don't think you're not going to find too many humanist groups on like Oral Roberts or Regents University or anything like that, since pretty much everyone going there is going to be a Bible believer and whatnot. But yeah, with schools that are more conservative but still are still accepting of you don't have to be a Catholic to go to St. Thomas or St. Kate's, with in those environments you can, it is, there are, there's a lot of interest in forming a group, but then, you know, there's also a lot of not outright like suppression or anything like that, but the university will, you know, throw up its roadblocks or whatnot to make it more difficult for the group to form and sustain itself.
Well, but actually finding some resistance can be just as much of an incentive to get organized as well. You know, knowing you're going to piss somebody off.
Definitely.
But, so given that that's the part of the dynamic is that students don't tend to get interested in these kinds of issues until they think that they're going to be taken away, which is true of a lot of things. Like, you know, you don't get interested in global peace until, or students in general don't, until it becomes a domestic issue because soldiers are being sent abroad or whatever.
Right.
The rise of the religious right and its instantiation in the Bush administration in such a much more dramatic and visible way than it has been in even the Reagan administration. Has that gotten students who are left of the Attila the Hun concerned about the effect of the religious right on American politics? And has that given this impetus to the growth of the student secular movement?
I think it has. I think that's definitely helped. And but a lot of the thing too is for a lot of these secular and, you know, humanist students and whatnot, they'll become more concerned and they'll become more active and more involved. So they'll be more likely to maybe want to start a group or stuff. But again, like I was saying before, a lot of times they'll still go to some other groups for specific types of activism and stuff like that. With, you know, in regards to what the Bush administration is doing, like going to, like, joining Amnesty International and stuff in terms of, like, civil rights stuff, because a lot of campus humanist and atheist groups, it's not that they can't focus on that or that they won't, but a lot of times there is more diversity of thought in a campus group in regards to exactly, you know, specific political views and stuff like that. Like, I've noticed on a lot of campus groups, and even some adult groups in the AHA network, there's a lot stronger, like, libertarian component there. So sometimes in campus groups, that can almost create a certain kind of tension where the group actually is kind of wants to go in two different directions. So there's kind of that issue too that we always consider. But I think what's been going on with the Bush administration and whatnot has helped spur a lot more activism. That and just, you know, having an employee now full time who can kind of work on all that and help organize these kids and get them motivated and involved and active.
Now I want to take you. Oh, by the way, I'm speaking with Junda Huang. He's the field organizer for the American Humanist Association, and I'm Jay Hughes. This is Change Surfer Radio. I want to take you to a slightly more delicate place. I know that the Secular Student Alliance is that it? Secular Student Alliance?
Yep, Secular Student Alliance
has made overtures and is working in cooperation with the Council for Secular Humanism's student chapters as well, and which is a very positive sign, because the division of the American Humanist movement into these two organizations has been unfortunate. Could you give us just a thumbnail of what were some of the dynamics that led to the growth of these two different secular humanist organizations in the United States, and are there movements towards bringing the humanist movement into closer cooperation?
Yeah, there's definitely movement to bring our movement to kind of work together on an organizational level. We have things like the Coalition for the Community of Reason, which had been started by an atheist activist, Herb Silverman, down in South Carolina, and it was, you know, a meeting of all the national leaders of the 7 or 8 free thought, you know, atheist humanist groups around the country, and just kind of talk about issues of common concern. So That's been kind of going on for a while, on and off, and that's been a major coalition effort.
You cooperated on the Godless March on Washington, right?
Yes, we all did. Yeah, the American Humanist Association was there, and so was the Council for Secular Humanism, American Atheist, which was the primary sponsor of the march, and then Atheist Alliance International and whatnot. So yeah, something like that was, you know, pretty much maybe, you know, even 10 years ago, probably inconceivable. Even if American Atheist had decided to do something like that, the chances of the other organizations jumping on board were a lot more slim. But nowadays, you know, it's different. You know, there's you know, a lot of history, a lot of, you know, animosity and whatnot among, you know, the organizations. But there is definitely a call from, you know, just a lot of the members within all the different groups to kind of put all these aside and just kind of work together on, you know, the issues that we do, you know, the issues that we you all agree on, which, you know, is pretty much everything. A lot of it's just kind of differences in how we want to approach it and how we want to deal with it, which is actually kind of related to the Campus Rethought Alliance and the Secular Student Alliance, which the Campus Rethought Alliance, the CFA, had been started in, I believe it was 1996, by the Council and the Council for Secular Humanism. And they, you know, had an executive council, and they had conferences and whatnot. And then in 2000, some of the executive committee from the CFA decided to form their own group because they just wanted more kind of direct student involvement, because the CFA, which, you know, had a student executive committee, was still in the end, you know, under the auspices of, you know, Professor Paul Kurtz, who's the founder and chairman of the council and whatnot. So they wanted, the SSA kind of wanted a little more freedom to be able to work in coalition with other groups and just kind of have the final say on a lot of things, because I believe the way the CFA was and is, students have input definitely, but final say is still, it's still something the professional staff has, you know, like veto power over.
So what's the big agenda for the Secular Student Alliance and the student movement, the secular student movement in general? Is are you guys, you're a 501c3, right? So you can't get involved in explicitly partisan politics, but
right.
Clearly that's educating folks about the distinctions in the issues is one of the things that should be on your agenda.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, the things we're looking forward to right now, we are having a conference this fall, August 5th through the 7th, down here in Washington, D.C., so we're gearing up that for that. I mean, in general, the biggest things that the SSA is always working on and with a lot of is just kind of getting more students involved, getting them more active and wanting to form a group, because a lot of times you'll get kids who will email and say they're interested, and then once you give them some information and whatnot, sometimes they may back off. So it's the idea of keeping them engaged and, you know, giving them kind of the feeling of excitement that it's something that they want to do. So, yeah, and because we are nonpartisan, we're not really getting involved in politics, and the SSA is just, yeah, the SSA really isn't that interested at this point in specifically getting involved with a lot of political things. It's focused right now is just kind of the more nitty-gritty details of getting more and more campus groups going. We have a goal as part of the SSA strategic plan to get, I believe it's 250 campus groups going by 2006 or 2007. So,
do you have like a study group curricula that you have students start on to kind of educate, self-educate about humanist issues?
Not specifically. That is something I think that we would like to develop. A lot of times the SSA kind of relies on materials and whatnot from the national organization, from other national organizations. So, for example, if a student group wanted more information about humanism, the SSA might direct them to the AHA, and then we could just send them our brochures and pamphlets and talk with them about humanism and stuff like that. I mean, we would, I think, ideally at some point in the future, we would like to have some kind of intro to humanism course or something like that that students could kind of take.
Just one final question here, and that is about the unusual convergence that we mentioned before you came on air of the fact that both The Humanist, which is your national publication, and the Free Inquiry magazine, which is the national publication of the Council for Secular Humanism, both decided to focus this month on, in their cover articles, on transhumanism and the issues raised by biotechnology. Do you see this as an emergent set of concerns on the part of secular students and secular activists in general, that the culture war is beginning to get into these issues of biotechnology?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, just looking at things with President Bush and his Council on Bioethics and Leon Klass and whatnot, seeing this kind of, you know, the whatever he talks about, that feeling of repugnance or whatever.
Wisdom of repugnance, yeah.
Yeah, wisdom of repugnance for his justification. I mean, things like that are just, you know, as far as I'm concerned, are just kind of out there and stuff. So I think kind of seeing that and seeing this turn toward these issues, and, you know, between that and the fact that we're just kind of getting inundated a lot more now with, you know, all this information about these new technologies and new advancements and, you know, with nanotechnology and stuff like that becoming more and more, you know, not just some obscure story you're going to find in the back of Wired or something like that, but, you know, the New York Times or whatever is doing pieces on it. I think with things like that, it's clear that it's becoming more and more of an issue, and, you know, the transhumanist movement is, you know, growing too. Our humanism is, you know, our organizations, our members are becoming more and more aware of all this. So So I think that's part of the reason why that there's both these cover stories and just kind of this general interest and whatnot.
How can people get a hold of the American Humanist Association and find you if they're interested in starting a student chapter?
Yeah, the best way would be to visit our website, which is www.americanhumanist.org, and there you'll be able to find links for our chapters and affiliates, and you can just email me there. My email is jhuang@americanhumanist.org. And the Secular Student Alliance, which is probably one of the best bets for getting, if you want to get a campus group going, can be found at www.secularstudents.org.
I really want to thank you for joining us today, Junda.
Thanks a lot.
I've been speaking with Junda Huang. He's the National Field Organizer for the American Humanist Association. This is from an essay that I just had published in Free Inquiry magazine, which is published by the Council for Secular Humanism. And it's in an essay, it's in an issue of Free Inquiry, the June-July 2004 issue, which has four cover articles and an editorial about upgrading humanity or people obsolete. So it's all about transhumanism, and all of the articles are very, very good, including my own, which I'm going to read to you, called Humanism for Personhood Against Human Racism, A New Fight for Human Rights. In February 2004, the Bush administration found pro-life bioethicists to replace two members of the President's Commission on Bioethics who had defended the use of embryos in stem cell research. In the case of Florida resident Terry Schiavo, the religious right continues to fight to keep alive a permanently unconscious woman whose husband would like to pull the plug. The Great Ape Project is fighting to ban experimentation on chimpanzees and gorillas. Technology critics like Langdon Winner, Francis Fukuyama, and Bill McKibben warn that humanity is threatened by an emergent post-humanity, while the National Science Foundation encourages the cross-fertilization of nanotechnology, biotechnology, and the information and cognitive sciences towards the goal of improving human performance. All these issues are connected as part of a broad political struggle between advocates and opponents of two basic humanist propositions. First, humanists believe that what is of value in human life is our capacity for thought, feeling, and conscience, our personhood, and not our biological characteristics like gender, race, or genome. Second, humanists believe we should be free from superstitious taboos and religious authority in our use of reason and science, that we should be able to freely use our human powers to reach our fullest potential. In previous eras, the struggle over these propositions emancipated slaves and gave women suffrage. The anti-humanists insisted that women and Africans were biologically incapable of equality with white men, while the humanists insisted that women and Africans had the same capacities for thought and feeling, and therefore the same right to citizenship. In the emerging biopolitics of the 21st century, the struggle will be to determine which kinds of life have rights and citizenship. For human racists, fetuses and the brain dead are vulnerable human beings facing slaughter. Champions of personhood see fetuses and the brain dead as pre- and post-persons, lives without interests. Only persons have interests, such as women wanting to control their bodies, the disabled and sick looking for therapies from stem cells, and families waiting to bury their dead. Advocates of personhood take seriously the claims of great apes and cetaceans to some rough moral parity with humanity on the basis of their cognitive complexity, while human racists reject rights for non-humans out of hand. Now that we're on the cusp of transcending the human condition, of living longer, healthier, and smarter than our ancestors, the human racists insist on divine prohibitions and dire consequences for our hubris. In their essay, Protecting the Endangered Human, for instance, bioethicists George Annis and Laurie Andrews call for an international treaty to make it a crime against humanity to improve genomes in ways that children could inherit. Inheritable genetic modification, they say, quote, can alter the essence of humanity itself and thus threaten to change the foundation of human rights by taking human evolution into our own hands and directing it towards the development of a new species, sometimes termed the post-human. Membership in the human species is central to the meaning and enforcement of human rights, unquote. But the humanist tradition does not fetishize biological humanness, and human rights do not depend on biological similarity. Not all biological humans are persons, fetuses and the brain dead, for instance, and biological humanness is irrelevant to personhood. John Locke defined a person as a thinking, intelligent being that has reason and reflection and can consider itself, as itself, the same thinking thing in different times and places. As humanists facing the challenges of contemporary biotechnology, we need to embrace a transhuman understanding of the humanist project and humanist values, a humanism beyond human racism. The transhumanist works towards the fullest flowering of all persons' potentials, freeing them from the domination of other people, ensuring that they are educated, housed, and fed, and that they are empowered to control their own lives. John Stuart Mill said, "What more can be said of any condition of human affairs than that it brings human beings themselves nearer to the best thing that they can be?" Creating institutions to fulfill the promise of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights would be a great step towards this goal. But reaching our fullest potential also requires access to technology, from the printed word and electricity to vaccinations and birth control. With democracy and human rights, we push back the social and economic constraints on our personhood. With technology, we push back the natural constraints. Humanists and transhumanists need to wage a global campaign to radicalize the idea of human rights in the coming decades. We need to assert our rights to control our own bodies and brains, whether we choose to change our genders or medicate our brains. We need to assert that the measure of a society's fairness is how universally available it makes the prerequisites for achieving our fullest potential. We need to defend the right to enhance ourselves, whether through education and exercise or genetic engineering and cybernetic implants. We need to extend these human rights and citizenship not only to all humans, regardless of nationality, but to all persons, ape, human, post-human, or machine. We need to build the global institutions that can protect the rights of persons and expand the freedoms they enjoy. To the extent that we succeed in our campaign for personhood over human racism, we will fulfill the dreams of our humanist forebears like Giovanni Pico della Mirandola, who wrote in the Oration on the Dignity of Man that you as a human, quote, with no limit or bound, may choose for yourself the limits and bounds of your nature. To you is granted the power, contained in your intellect and judgment, to be reborn into the higher forms, the divine. To man it is allowed to be whatever he chooses to be. That was the essay that I wrote for the Free Inquiry magazine from the Council for Secular Humanism. It was the essay Humanism for Personhood Against Human Racism, A New Fight for Human Rights, and that's found in the June-July 2004 issue of Free Inquiry, which you can find out about subscribing to at secularhumanism.org. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.